Welcome to Alameda Community Radio's News and Views. I'm your host, Susan Galley-Moore, and I'll be with you for this view into the workings and goings-on in our city of Alameda.
October, the Navy announced unilaterally that they were going to reduce the number of RAB meetings from monthly to quarterly. And we were given a choice of what months we wanted to meet, but we didn't vote on that because we didn't want to endorse the cutting back the number of meetings.
That's the voice of George Humphreys, who has served on the Restoration Advisory Board for more than a decade. As you may know, the RAB is the community that the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, describes as, and I'm going to quote from the EPA website, an expansion of the Department of Defense's Technical Review Committee concept. The boards are a forum for exchange of information and partnership among citizens, the installation, EPA, and state. Most importantly, they offer an opportunity for communities to provide input to the cleanup process. It is our view that RABs will improve DOD's cleanup program by increasing community understanding and support for cleanup efforts, improving the soundness of government decisions, and ensuring cleanups are responsive to community needs. That's a quote defining what a Restoration Advisory Board is from the EPA. Now, the Navy has recently declared that the monthly RAB meetings held at Alameda Point will no longer be monthly, but they're going to go to a quarterly system. We're going to talk about that today with George Humphreys. He's a longtime resident of Alameda, and he retired from a 39-year career with Kaiser Engineers in Oakland. Cleaning up Alameda Point has continued for more than a dozen years, and I've attended the monthly RAB meetings for about the last 5 years or so. Here's George Humphreys describing his areas of expertise.
I started working on nuclear plants, and then I worked on water desalination plants, waste-to-energy plants, garbage disposal, landfills, and I think about the last 8 or 10 years I worked on hazardous waste sites also.
This is a wide-ranging conversation with George as an initial step into bringing more information about the cleanup to City of Alameda residents. I asked George to give us an overview of the cleanup.
As far as what the Navy's been doing, last year one of the big efforts that they had was the dredging of the Seaplane Lagoon, or I should say the corners of the Seaplane Lagoon. And that's the northwest corner and the northeast corner. I think they've only dredged one of the corners so far. And they've been stockpiling that material on a big pad for dewatering.
And what are the chemicals of concern?
Cadmium, chromium, what they call DDX, which is the family of DDT compounds. DDT was developed during World War II as a pesticide. And I guess they're now saying that radium-226 is one of the chemicals of concern, although that wasn't designated as a chemical of concern originally for the Seaplane Lagoon.
Let's talk first about the cadmium, chromium, and the DDX. Where did they come from?
Well, the cadmium and chromium and other heavy metals like that came from plating shops. One area was what they call Building 5, which is the large building. It's about 20 acres in size, 950,000 square feet, something like that. I think they had other plating shops to the east of the Seaplane Lagoon, and those drained in along the east side of the Seaplane Lagoon. The lines from Building 5 drained into the northwest corner and the northeast corner.
And when you say drains, we're talking about storm drains.
Yeah, storm drains and industrial drains. I think that the material that was dumped into drains went into those same lines.
I've heard that some people refer to them as sewer drains, but they're really not sewer drains, are they?
No, they're not for domestic sewage, no.
And then let's talk a little bit about the radium that was unexpectedly discovered there. Where did that come from?
Well, it probably came from Building 5. I think what you're talking about is along the west side of the Seaplane Lagoon. Some people from the Radiological Assessment Support Office were walking along the lagoon with their radiation monitors, and they hadn't turned them off, and they hit a hot spot of radium material that nobody knew was there, and apparently somebody must have just dumped it there. It looked like a big glob of paint, you know, an area like maybe 5 feet by 10 feet, something like that.
So barrels or something just buried?
No, it wasn't barrels. I think it was more like a layer of stuff, you know, like 6 or 8 inches thick, although it goes down deeper because they've excavated all along and back of that sheet piling. I've never really been able to get over there to see that myself because it's kind of fenced off.
So when you hear now about these heavy metals and the radium, these chemicals of concern, do you have any concerns about what's happening at Seaplane Lagoon?
Well, I don't think they're excavating enough of it, but that's sort of a done deal. We fought the battle and lost on that. The people that did the environmental assessment on that used what they called a site utilization factor. They had the Audubon Society do a bird count survey and then calculated the fraction of the time that the birds were, that they saw birds at the Seaplane Lagoon, and they used that as a factor to reduce the dose that the wildlife was getting. Incidentally, the risk assessments there were based on wildlife risk assessments rather than human risk assessments. That seemed to be the controlling factor. And then they had fish species that they looked at. But they didn't have any toxicity data for the fish species, so they ended up using data from Pearl Harbor on fish toxicity.
I'm not quite sure how that translates. Can you just unfold that a little more?
Yeah, I'll try. They started with the number of grams of the contaminant per weight of flesh of the particular species they're concerned with as being the health effect, and then they translate that from one kind of fish to another. There are some what they call tests that they do with stickleback minnows, where they immerse them in a liquid for a certain period of time, like 6 weeks, to see whether how many of them die and that sort of thing. But they tried to do something like that at Site 2, which is one of the big landfills out there. But they couldn't find enough fish to do the tests with, really.
So at this point, Seaplane Lagoon, the big dewatering pads are out there for anyone to see, and the idea is that they're going to test the material, the dredge material, and decide, based on its hazard quotient, what to do with it.
Yeah, more or less. At first, they're going to dewater the stuff, and this is something I don't understand myself, because what they say is that they will test the material for concentrations of toxins. But what appears to be happening is as they're dewatering, they're turning the stuff over and mixing it up so that the concentrations, we'll say, of cadmium, for example, if there was a certain clump of material that was high in cadmium, it would get mixed with other material and diluted in concentration. So then when you went back, say, 6 months later to measure to take a sample, it might not be representative of what you started out with, nor would you know where it came from. In other words, you take a scoop of stuff out of the lagoon, dump it there, and then later you start mixing it around. You don't have a record of where that particular scoop went, so you don't know where the hot spot was, maybe.
Is that a concern for you?
Well, it is. I guess if I were doing it, I would try to find some way of segregating the material so that you knew where the highest contamination levels came from, and then you could test further in that area to see if there was any more of it. But with all of the mixing thing, you're liable to end up with a lot of stuff that's been diluted down by the mixing operation so that you suddenly can declare that it's all safe to dispose of.
And let's talk about the disposal for a moment. I've heard a couple of different scenarios. One, that the extra hazardous material will be taken to a hazardous material site. but that the remaining material might be used to create the engineered underground slabs.
I don't know about underground slabs. There's only one hazardous material dump in California. When I started in the business, there were about eight, but now there's just the one at Kettleman City that Waste Management operates. And the radioactive materials, there's no low-level waste site in California. There was supposed to be one in the Mojave Desert, but that one got turned down. I think the Department of Interior turned it down. And so the material was going to some place in Utah, the radioactive material that they hauled off.
The bulk of the material that's there, do you know what they're going to be doing with it?
No, I don't. It's been hard to find out. I think what they do is they take it to Altamont, most of it. There are places at Altamont that they have pits where you can dispose of things like lead paint and asbestos and that sort of material.
But there are, I would say, hundreds of thousands of barrels. Let's use some sort of quantity that makes sense of dredge material out there on the dewatering pads.
Yeah, I think it was something like 115,000 cubic yards that they were proposing to excavate, and I think they've done like half of it so far. But
I want to switch from the Seaplane Lagoon. We're going to have more information about that over time. Generally, talk about your service on the RAB and what your concerns are about a quarterly system.
Well, for one thing, having a meeting every month, it gives some continuity to the thing, and people get used to going to a meeting on a certain day of the month. With a quarterly, and you may not know, it may be, say, February, May, September, October, or whatever. So you kind of have to plan your year out in advance. A lot of people will have plans made already and maybe won't show up or forget about the meeting or what have you.
And what about following the cleanup process?
Well, the other thing is when they put out reports, they'll put out a big report, and then you're supposed to comment on one within 30 days or 60 days. So it may be that when you have a meeting that the report was issued 2 months ago and the deadline for commenting on the report is coming up in 2 or 3 weeks or something like that, so you may not have time to, you know, to review it properly. The material comes to the community co-chair, so, you know, as a member, you don't see the material unless you know that that thing came up. It used to be that we had a list that the Navy would put out on what reports they were issuing and when, so you'd kind of be on the lookout for a certain report, but now that doesn't seem to be happening.
Is that something that you would push for again, to have that reinstalled or reinstated?
Yeah, I think that was a good thing to have. You knew that, you know, in a month or so there was a report coming out on a particular site, and if you were interested in it, you'd make a point to look it up or ask the co-chair if you could get, you know, could borrow the copy for a while.
It seems as though that's easy enough to do. I would imagine that the Navy wouldn't hesitate to do that. What do you think?
I would think so. They used to do it routinely, but lately they haven't been doing that.
Is there concerted effort by RAB members, and I'm talking now about the residents, the members of the RAB that are residents, to raise the issue about cutting back with the Navy and the city?
We've written to Congressman Stark and Congressperson Barbara Lee about our concerns, and are hoping that they will follow up with the Navy or the proper people in Department of Defense that are responsible for the decision to cut back the number of meetings. I'm not sure everyone on the RAB is concerned, because some people have been sitting on this RAB for 14 years, and they may be relieved that their workload is finally dropping off or something. Personally, I'd like to be around to see how it ends up as far as what the Navy actually does in the way of cleanup.
You're listening to Restoration Advisory Board member George Humphreys sharing his views on the ongoing cleanup at the Alameda Point. Humphreys retired after 39 years as an engineer, familiar with cleanups of this nature. This is Alameda Community Radio's News and Views. I'm Susan Gallimore, also a regular attendee at RAB meetings. I will also have links to maps of the cleanup sites on Alameda Community Radio's site, as well as more in-depth information on the blog Alameda Point Cleanup. So just do a search, Alameda Point Cleanup, and you'll get more in-depth information. You'll also find audio embedded into the website according to pertinent information that needs to be shared, and we will continue to build the site over time. There'll be a link to this blog in the Alameda Community Radio site, and I asked George Humphreys to review the areas on the point that are of most concern to him.
Well, I think early on I kind of identified certain sites. Site one, which is the first, I'd call it industrial waste dump. The Navy calls it a landfill, but it's an area on the northwest corner of the point that was operated as a landfill. And then on site two, which is another similar operation where they dumped everything, all kinds of waste that were generated on the point. The sequence was first site one and then site two. And they got all kinds of wastes, solvents, airplane parts, lumber, household garbage, paints, asbestos, radioactive materials. Anything they were trying to get rid of went into the site there. And because these weren't permitted landfills like we have now, there weren't any regulations, so they don't have a liner under them or a cap or any proper closure. And the Navy on both of them is just proposing to put a dirt cover over them, which is not really a cap. A cap usually has some specifications as to the permeability of the cap and has things like rodent barriers and vents for gases that might be given off and so forth. For example, there's a landfill out here on Bay Farm Island where they call Mount Trashmore, that has much more sophisticated and stringent controls on it than do either of these two dumps. And that site only got municipal garbage.
The general impression is it's not really too much to worry about out there because it's far away and it's going to be Tidelands Trust.
Well, I'm not sure what the Tidelands Trust aspect of it is, but if people think they're going to be building houses with beautiful views of San Francisco, they're mistaken. It'll just be open space. It may or may not be permitted to have trails through it or not. I've heard at Site 2 that the Navy is not going to allow trails through there. But anyway, both of these things are probably leaking materials into the bay at a slow rate.
When you say you think things are leaking in there, can you give an idea of what kinds of things and why you think they might be leaking?
Well, they're mainly solvents. Perchloroethylene, trichloroethylene, vinyl chloride, that's a degradation product of solvents. And there's a plume in site one, and they have wells that are, say, 100 feet from the bay that show concentrations, and they don't take any samples right at the edge of the bay, so we don't know if it continues on or not, but at some point, the tidal influence of the bay, the tide starts coming back in under the land and diluting the stuff that's flowing out. But this has been going on for 15 or 20 years.
To learn more about this plume, I'll be posting audio from an interview with Fred Hoffman. Hoffman was a RAB member for 2 years, and he has extensive experience as a contaminant hydrologist, familiar with Superfund sites from his work at Lawrence Livermore National Lab. Unfortunately, Fred Hoffman is no longer a member of the RAB, but I'm sure that he's more than willing to share his information. In fact, he did that in this audio interview with me. So go to the site and find audio from a contaminant hydrologist. So I asked George Humphreys about what is known as the skeet shooting range and the chemicals of a concern generated from that activity.
Well, that was, they would fire shotguns at skeet out there. So there's an area of lead where there's a lot of lead shot. Again, this was one of these analyses they did. I think the area is about 200 yards long and say, 50 yards wide. And there were hundreds of lead shot, you know, in a sample of material. They had a biological risk assessment done, and they looked at these surf scotters and said a surf scotter will dive down and pick up one lead shot per day or something like that, and then did an analysis based on that. They spent a lot of money sampling it and analyzing it and doing studies on it. It probably would have been just as cheap to dug the stuff up, but anyway, the decision was made that they would leave it there and that the siltation process would cover it up and it wouldn't be any problem. I've been concerned, and I've mentioned it several times, and I don't think the Navy has responded to it, that during storms, big waves would come along, and the bigger waves, then the wave action goes down under the water to a greater depth. So this stuff is at a depth, say, of maybe 15 feet or something like that, that lead shot could be picked up and carried up onto the beach area. They were supposed to have sampled along the beach, but I've never heard the results of what the sampling was.
I'm imagining something like a pellet of lead. Why should we be concerned about it if it's, you know, there in a contained size and shape and form?
As the lead got absorbed into the flesh of the bird, then, of course, if the bird was shot or eaten by somebody, then it'd be a potential risk to humans, but otherwise to other animals in the food chain.
So we don't need to be concerned about lead particles or something actually being eroded off this pellet?
Well, I think it would be gradually. If you have, you know, it oxidizes, so you get a film. So, it's the same as lead paint flaking off of a house or something like that and getting into the soil. And also, the wave action is the sand and so forth is moving around out there. Imagine eventually those lead pellets would get ground down to smaller and smaller pieces going into the bay.
That was Site 1 and Site 2, and I appreciate that. And again, I will make sure that we have a map for people to look at if they want to. What other site gives you a reason for concern?
Building 5, which is Site 5. And it's part of what they call OU-2C. That's a large building where they repaired airplanes. They rebuilt airplanes in this building. And inside of it, they had plating shops and foundries, all kinds of metalworking equipment. On a mezzanine level, they used radium paint to paint luminescent dials for aircraft. Some of the paint was dumped down the drain, apparently, and got into the seaplane lagoon. Others of it, in the early days, was directed towards the estuary and the turning basin out there, part of the estuary. Under that, there was a large plume of what they call DNAPLs, which is dense non-aqueous phase liquids, and that was down about 30 feet or so under the floor. The Navy spent 2 or 3 years working in different areas. There was what they call six-phase heating. We're passing electric current through the soil to raise it up to near something like 290 or 200 degrees, but not to boiling point. And that basically volatilized these solvents, went through a collection system, and was adsorbed and hauled away. So that part of it has been pretty well taken care of, but the other contamination, like the radium that's in pipes under the floor, heavy metals under the floor and so forth, apparently are just going to be left there because they're depending on the floor to provide protection. So basically that building and that area is dedicated to commercial or industrial use only. In fact, SunCal's plan called for tearing that building down and building multiple unit housing in that area. Well, that wasn't compatible with the way the Navy was cleaning it up.
Meaning?
Well, the Navy is only was going by a master plan that the city developed. It was adopted as the official plan, and that showed it as being that building as being commercial industrial. one of the problems with the base is that the higher elevation areas are where the industrial operations were carried out, like Building 5 and the areas to the east of the Seaplane Lagoon. The areas where there was officers' housing and NCO housing and so forth is to the north along the estuary, probably not as contaminated as much, but it's also subject to flooding. It would flood during high water incidents. So you have the basic conundrum is, do you bring in a lot of fill material to build up the clean areas, or do you build on the dirty areas? It really turns out, when people have looked at it and thought about it, that most of the areas that you might think about being desirable to build something on from an aesthetic perspective are not really capable of being cleaned up that much to be useful. Another dirty area is what they call Operable Unit 2B, which is near the east gate where Aposado Way comes in, and there's a kind of a elliptical-shaped entrance area with an airplane on a pedestal. And that area goes way back. It was originally, there was a oil refinery there called Pacific Coast Refining, but a lot of heavy industrial operations by the Navy were in that area. And that's one of the most polluted areas. So when you think of, you know, having a luxury condo facing on the Seaplane Lagoon with views of San Francisco, it's probably not realistic.
I've heard the Navy and I believe the city also say that over time, natural attenuation will take care of some of these issues that we're raising here.
Yeah, to some extent that's true. I mean, there are organisms in the soil that will naturally try to use hydrocarbons for food. But the Navy also takes credit for dilution. In other words, if you have a plume or an underground lake of contamination that's slowly flowing in a direction, in this case, in case of Operable Unit 2B, the plume is flowing into the Seaplane Lagoon, and there are cross-sections that show it diving down under the seawall. So the rationale is that if it's coming out slow enough that it gets diluted by the water in the Seaplane Lagoon, but it's basically bad stuff that's getting out and contaminating the whole environment.
Well, we are going to continue this conversation. At the moment, though, I want you to speak directly to the residents in Alameda and see if you can find a way to encourage them to get more involved.
We have these meetings. They were once a month. Now they'll be quarterly. I think you'd have to go out there and attend a number of these meetings to get a flavor for what's going on. But that would be the best way to get a feeling to satisfy yourself about the cleanup effort.
And again, we will have George Humphreys on the radio show again, and he will be more than happy to help educate people. George, you mentioned a letter that the RAB members are pulling together and sending to Barbara Lee and Pete Stark. Can residents do the same?
Yeah, I would think so. If they're concerned about it, it would be a good idea to reinforce that.
Is there any way you could give us an overview of what you're saying in that letter?
Well, we're saying that the Navy unilaterally announced that they're reducing the number of meetings, that it would be disruptive to the continuity of our operation. It seems to have been justified as a cost-cutting measure, which they claim they're spending $10,000 to $25,000 a meeting. We think there's a lot of information that we need to know as to what the Navy is doing as far as cleanup is concerned. That certainly one of the excuses has been, even with the monthly meetings, that they don't have enough time to present what's going on. And we get abbreviated presentations with not too much technical detail in it.
It occurs to me that with the help of the city of Alameda, perhaps one of the things that could happen, given the technologies that we have available to us these days, is we could do a long-distance meeting. The San Diego people would no longer have to spend money to come up here, but we could do it through Skype or some kind of other remote conferencing software.
I guess that's a possibility, but of course the Navy, part of their expenses involved, when they do a presentation, they have to have consultants prepare material, prepare slides for them, and actually a lot of the presentation is done by consultants, so that expense would still be there.
So maybe there's a way we can continue to negotiate about how to do meetings every month and do them in a more innovative way than bringing everybody together physically into one room.
Yeah, that's a possibility. We also suggested the Navy and the regulators have another meeting that they call the BRAC cleanup team that meets monthly also. We suggested, well, why don't you have the RAB meetings on the same night that you have that meeting? That way the people don't have to travel up here twice, but there hasn't been any response to that.
That was George Humphreys. Now, as host of Alameda Community Radio's News and Views, I will continue to follow the story. I have invited other members of the RAB to share their experiences with Alameda residents, and I want to particularly recognize Gene and Jim Sweeney's efforts on the RAB. Gene Sweeney worked tirelessly on this board, and I have an audio interview I conducted with her a couple of years ago that I hope I can share. Meanwhile, learn more. There's my blog, Alameda Point Cleanup, and other blogs in Alameda about the issue offering perspectives too, some of which tend to be more personal or more personalized. Then again, I believe the more factual information in the community, the better your opportunity to understand the issues. If you want to contact me directly, you can do so at alamedacommunityradio@gmail.com. So all one word, alamedacommunityradio@gmail.com. You can also leave a quick phone message for me at 510-545-8865. So there's two ways to reach me, alamedacommunityradio@gmail.com or 510-545-8865.